welcome to History Now. On today's show, I'm very happy to say that we're going to be looking at a very important person in terms of Belfast history, Mary-Anne McCracken. And on today's show, we have Aaron McIntyre and Paula Reynolds from Clifton House, the home of the Belfast Charitable Society. You're very welcome. So Paula, Mary-Anne McCracken came from a very prominent Belfast family with ties to a lot of industry and newspapers. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about her family?
Well, on the Joy side, so on her mother's side, actually, her grandfather then was Francis Joy, who was a prominent businessman and an attorney in Belfast through the early 1700s. And he actually, through a bad debt, came to own the like a printing press and decided to put it to use. So he actually set up what is now the newsletter newspaper and is the oldest running newspaper in that format in the world. So he was very much to the fore in Belfast society. He had three children, two sons, Robert and Henry, and then Anne, who then becomes Mary Anne's mother. So Robert and Henry Joy were again very involved in the business life in Belfast, and they were to the fore in setting up Belfast Charitable Society at a time in the 1750s when the population of Belfast was only 8,500. So then her mother went on to marry John McCracken. So John McCracken was a seafarer, a sea captain, had his own ships, and again a very influential person within the industry and within business in Belfast. So you can see from early days, you know, the roots were there in terms of their links to the world, effectively, to industry in Belfast, and they were very prominent at a time when Belfast had a smaller population.
The reason that the Joys and McCrackens were in Belfast was because of religious persecution. The Joy family can trace their roots back to the French Protestants, the Huguenots, who fled persecution in France. And also the McCrackens came from Scotland during the time when the Covenanters were being persecuted, and came to Hill Hall outside Lisburn and then on to Belfast, where the two families met.
And they set up what was the first poor house in Belfast, essentially?
So originally, actually, the poor house was set up by Belfast Charitable Society in August 1752. Belfast Charitable Society was established, but that was established by 18 industrialist philanthropists in Belfast at the time. Now, the Joys weren't involved until a few months later. So you can see from our minutes books then, on the 30th of August 1752, 18 Presbyterian industrialist, sort of progressive liberal type businessmen from the town of Belfast who were very concerned about the poor and the welfare of the poor of Belfast came together with what was then the Vicar of Belfast, who would have been the Church of Ireland minister effectively, and they came together in a pub, as Aaron says in his tour, you know, where most good decisions are made on a Friday night in a pub. And they decided that they want to help the poor, and the best way for them to do that was to build the poor house, which would also act as the first hospital in Belfast. And originally they actually thought about building a church in the same sort of site, of the same complex as we would call it today. So we find then within our minutes, a couple of months later, you see the likes of Robert Joy and Henry Joy being invited into this band of progressive liberal, you know, thinkers. And Henry Joy then goes on to be like the project manager for the building of Clifton House, and Robert Joy actually is the architect.
On the subject of architecture, if you can just tell us a bit about that, but I'm particularly interested in the spire that we see in Clifton House, if you can give a bit of historical context to that and why that was significant.
Yeah, after several years of fundraising, they had enough money by 1768, £7,000 in total, to start the construction of the house. But unfortunately for them, they didn't have a design. So they wrote off to eminent architects right across Great Britain and Ireland, and even some places in mainland Europe. But being typical Belfast men, when these designs came back, there was stalemate on the committee, and not one person could pick one design that had a unanimous decision. And so they heard that Robert Joy, Mary Anne's uncle, had done some sketches on the back of a linen napkin, and he didn't want to show the board. Apparently he was mortified when they asked to see them, because they were just his own private doodles. And when they brought them forward to the committee, they agreed unanimously that's what they wanted the poor house to look like. So everything that you see today at the front facade of the building is originally designed by a complete amateur. And there was quite an unusual addition to the building. You have the spire on top, and the reason for this was actually quite political, because during this period you have the penal laws, which affect basically anybody outside of the Church of Ireland faith. And so one of the things that was impacted was the architecture of the religious buildings. They weren't allowed to have spires or bell towers, because these would have been the skyscrapers of the day and were really political statements. And so they put one onto the poor house, because it wasn't a religious building. They found a loophole in the law, and the Chichester family were furious because there was nothing that they could do to intervene. So at that point, they were building St. Anne's, the original St. Anne's, where the cathedral is today. And when they were building it, they decided to add on a double height spire to make it taller than the Pur House. So there's politics and everything, including architecture.
Yeah, and they're just so close to each other, so this is very, very noticeable. Mm-hmm. And so Aran, her early life and her education, would you say that sowed the seeds for a radical outlook and, or, you know, for the rest of her life, really?
Most definitely. When you look at what she was doing from a very early age, she was making clothes for the children of the Pur House with her mother. And when her mother was coming up to the Pur House to deliver the clothes, Mary Ann was allowed to come with her. And as Anne conversed with her brothers in the boardroom upstairs, Mary Ann was allowed to play with the children of the Pur House. So it had an impact on her from a very early age. And also her educational background. Her parents were very progressive, and they sent all of their children to the David Manson School, which was quite a forward-thinking idea in its day. They didn't have any corporal punishment. They instead rewarded the children for good behaviour in terms of promoting them through the ranks of society. So you could move from being a serf or a servant, if you did well, to being a king or queen. And if you misbehaved in class, you could be put down so the king could become a servant to somebody else who'd been better behaved or had been able to do their homework. And it was quite unusual for girls to be educated with boys during that period, but this is one of the first co-educational schools, and the McCracken family made sure that their children went to it.
They were very much influenced, these people, by the French Revolution and by, you know, the war in America and whatever too. But when her father, John McCracken, was actually captured at one stage and imprisoned in Bordeaux for a few months, there's a lot of correspondence back and forward from Bordeaux to the family, where he's telling them that, don't worry, he's having a great time, he's really enjoying the company and enjoying the wine even more. And so much so, when he comes back to Belfast, he actually seeks out the only native sort of French person in Belfast, and he commissions them, engages them, employs them to actually train and teach all of the McCracken children in French. So they spoke French, you know, which is, again, so much very progressive for the time.
You know? And presumably the speaking French and growing up bilingual would increase their sort of interest in the French Revolution and that
through their links, as well, too. So,
So I'd just like to speak now about, of course, so we can't talk about Mary Ann McCracken without at least mentioning her brother. Yeah. Now, for a long time, her brother was the most famous person in the family, and understandably so, Henry Joy McCracken. But it's kind of overshadowed her in previous decades, and perhaps unfairly, because she was a radical for basically all her life. Yeah. So what was her relationship with her brother? If I can go to you first, Aran.
Her relationship with her brother, they were very close. They were only about 2 years difference in age, so they grew up together, they played together, and when it came to the likes of the United Irishmen, they were very active together in the plans for the United Irishmen rebellion. But before they were even involved with such a radical movement, they were themselves setting up what we like to think of as the first integrated school in Belfast. It was a Sunday school for the poor, and it didn't matter whether you were Roman Catholic, if you were a dissenter or from the Church of Ireland, you could come along to this school. But it was seen to be so radical, and actually was described as being seditious, that the local Church of Ireland vicar had it shut down. So this was really the first flavour of what really drove them towards radicalism. I think that it impacted on them and had quite a drastic impact moving forward.
And Paula, same to you. What we, in your looking at the minutes and things like that there, and the vast resource you have up in Clifton House, what sense do you get from the relationship?
Very much the doting sister. Do you know what I mean? She really did look after him and very much cared for him. Aran's alluded there too. You know, their part in the United Irishmen. I mean, when he was on the run, effectively, as we would know it today, I mean, she sort of put her own life at risk. There was curfews in Belfast. She and her sister, their other sister, Margaret, would have went off into the Belfast Hills to find him at various stages, and did so. And she also actually tried to help him escape and to leave and get off to America. Now, he was, as we know, caught, abducted himself, or, and then imprisoned. And we know, again, from other sources, and not necessarily from our own minutes, but we also know that, you know, she was there when he was hung and actually stayed with him at the gallows. And there was a sense that he had something that he wanted to tell her but wouldn't. And in the end, then she actually found out that he had had an illegitimate child who she went and sought out. And then she took her on and adopted the child effectively and looked after her, which again in those days would have been very much going against the grain, as we know Marianne definitely, you know, was fit to do. You know, her friends and her family sort of advised her against looking after the child, but Marianne went ahead, adopted the child and basically reared her for all of her life too. You know,
throughout, there's a lot of examples of her radicalism, from really small gestures right through to what we'll talk about in a few minutes. But something that just you spoke about there just made me think about the fact that she came from a family who were connected to the newsletter.
Yeah.
Although she didn't read the newsletter, she actually read the sort of radical alternative to that. Could you maybe tell us about that?
So as we mentioned earlier, her family had set up the Belfast Newsletter in the 1730s, and when she reached an age to be interested in politics, another paper had been set up in Belfast, which was the organ of the United Irishmen, which is called the Northern Star. And she writes in one of her letters, after waking up from a fever, after a few weeks of being bedridden, she berates herself for missing so many stars. So whilst the Belfast Newsletter was the family paper, it would have been in the home, she was still going out and buying the more radical newspaper that was challenging the views of the more moderate reformers. And that ties in with her relationship with Henry Joy McCracken. They were that wee bit more radical within the family. As you say, Marianne took in Maria against the wishes of her family. And there's one letter that goes back to John McCracken, the older sibling, that states it, referring to the child, has come into our house against our will. And Marianne was very conscious of how people viewed the family as well. So she sent the young girl, Maria, to a boarding school outside of Belfast where nobody would know her, in order for people to sort of not know the story behind her and hopefully accept her for who she was, which I think is quite telling.
So what you get from hearing about her, she's very concerned with children, and this came on into her later years in terms of children's rights.
Yeah.
Could you, Paula, perhaps tell us about her human rights record when it came to children?
Well, when it came to children, very much involved into the fore of making sure that they were educated in the first instance. And again, we think that's come back from the very fact that David Manson School, how she was educated and how education was seen as very important within the home place. But she really drove and spearheaded the campaign to have children educated in the poor house. So there was education, sort of more numeracy and literacy, if you like, for those between the age of 7 and 11. But she very much drove and argued with the men's committee that they needed to have a broader, more comprehensive education, to have the arts, to have sport, to be taught geography, you know, to be involved in a broader, more holistic sort of education package, if you like. We can also see through the archive and through a series of letters between the Ladies' Committee, which Marianne chaired, and the Gentlemen's Committee, whereby Marianne is trying to set up the infant school at the poor house. So basically she writes to the gentlemen and asks them for some money for resources. They effectively ignore the letter. A couple of months later, a similar letter goes to the board, it's ignored again. And then a couple of months later, there's a letter to the board telling them of the successes of the, you know, of the school that she set up, and telling them how much they owe her. So she's basically gone ahead without their permission, if you like, to set up, you know, the school. So again, very much to the fore in human rights around education. But also she was key to a vast apprenticeship programme that ran out of the poor house, because the whole ethos of the poor house and Belfast Charitable Society was to help the poor in terms of feeding them, clothing them, educating them, but empowering them through having some form of industry and some means to make money themselves. So there was a very, very wide apprenticeship programme ran, which again Marianne fought for a very detailed contract to be written and to be agreed between the host employer, if you like, and the apprentice from the poor house. So much so that the board then actually made two unannounced visits to each of the apprenticeships throughout each year. And there was, as I say, a very detailed contract to really look after the rights of the children who were employed or hosted in any of the apprenticeships. So as far away as Newry at that time, the board would have went twice a year, which would have been maybe a 14-hour journey, just to check in to see if the kids were being looked after. And we believe that it did work out, because again, from our archive, we can see a lot of instances where people who had their holidays during their apprenticeship came back to the poor house to have their holiday there. And so,
It sounds like a very modern way of overseeing people under your care.
Yeah.
And another thing that struck me as being very modern is that she actually took business people to court for their treatment of child labour.
When they were going out and doing their welfare visits for the apprentices, if they thought that the indenture or the contract wasn't being met, or the child was suffering, either not getting enough food or wasn't getting the right pay, that Mary Ann and some of the ladies would have taken them to court. Sometimes they won, sometimes they lost, but they weren't afraid to challenge those who they saw as breaking the rules or abusing the children.
They actually bring in external examiners, if you like, to inspect, to make sure that they're almost safeguarding and checking themselves that they're doing the thing right. So we have reports from the 1836 of an inspector who has come into the poor house and you know, has put forward recommendations which are taken on board. So you get the likes of children, make sure that the children are given meat 3 times a week, which again, outside of the poor house, you wouldn't have got that. You see that they get, and again, because of Mary Ann, they're going to the Lammas Fair, they're taken to Bangor to go swimming a few times during the week. They're, you know, getting an hour's exercise during the day, walking around the grounds of the poor house to music. You know, a very comprehensive and wraparound approach to education that, you know, we almost think that we're inventing today, but really they did it, and possibly a lot better in their day than we're doing it now, you know.
One thing from the recommendations that actually really stood out for me was the fact that they recommended that shoes be given, good, strong, sturdy shoes be given to the children. And I don't know about either the two of you, but listening to tales of my nanny growing up in Belfast, in the 1930s, they didn't have shoes and they were running about in winter. But here the poor house was in the 1830s, having recommendations put in front of them and implementing them to have shoes, you know. So it was small things to help alleviate the situation that the children found themselves in. But it all did make a big difference to them.
But it was those things, I think, as well, that remind you that they were genuinely about empowering people and about equality, because they felt even though the children were poor, they were in their care, they were looking after them. And as I say, in some respects, they were actually being looked after better than those outside of the poor house too.
Yeah. There's one thing, and actually it was my first introduction to Mary Ann McCracken in her own right, was her lifelong crusade against slavery. Would you perhaps tell us something about that there, just to give us a bit of context?
Mary Ann McCracken's involvement with the anti-slavery movement goes right back to the early days of the United Irishmen. Alongside the United Irishmen, she wouldn't drink rum, she wouldn't take sugar or molasses, which her grandniece says that was a huge pain to her, because she did have a very sweet tooth, but she maintained her absence of those substances because of where they came from the slave trade. And her uncle, Henry Joy, gives a toast during one of the Georgian banquets in Belfast that states that if you are eating sugars, that you are part of the problem and not the solution. So I think it all stems back to her family's radical and progressive views. But in relation to Mary Ann's own involvement, she helped set up the Ladies Anti-Slavery League in Belfast with Martha Mateer, who was William Drennan's sister. And we all know, or a lot of people will know, William Drennan as the founder of the United Irishmen, but also he was a physician in the poor house. So he would have known Mary Ann McCracken and her wider family very intimately. When it comes to slavery, it goes right the way through her life. When there's advertisements put into the Belfast newsletter stating that young girls who were effectively slaves, we don't think of slaves coming into Belfast, but there were African Americans being used as servants. And when some of them ran away, advertisements would have been put into the newsletter stating that the young girls run away, if you find her, return her to her master's address. Mary Ann McCracken, always the tenacious lady that she was, would have put advertisements into the newspaper the next day stating that if this young slave girl could read, then please come to Miss McCracken's address where she'll pay for her emigration to Quebec. So again, she was always fighting against the status quo. And right up until her death, when she was within 17 days of being 89, she's still standing down in Belfast docks giving out anti-slavery leaflets. And she decries in her letters that she's the only one The Quakers have gone away from the movement, the Radical Presbyterians. She's the only stalwart still left there. And she actually writes in a letter in 1863 that she'll never see the end of slavery. But she's lucky in terms of in 1865, slavery is outlawed in America, and she dies the next year in 1866. So her lifelong crusade, she did see it out at the end.
So in terms of how she's been represented throughout history, and indeed how any women were represented who came from that time, were almost seen as almost a romantic interest or the servant of the more famous brother. And in terms of Mary Anne, she's in previous generations, she's been looked upon as a romantic interest for other United Irishmen. Can you perhaps tell us about that and why that doesn't ring true?
Well, I think that all stems to one letter. It's literally one line in one letter where she describes Thomas Russell. And she says that Thomas Russell is the kind of guy who would make a woman look twice. So you do get that flavour that she did find him attractive. But there's various commentaries, including those from men, stating that he was a very good looking young man. And I don't think that it rings true that necessarily that you writing that comment meant that you were infatuated or in love with them. I think during that period, the women were seen in the shadows of the men, and it sort of suited the political narratives going forward that the women did take a back seat and to put them in the shadow of the men as the romantic interest, as the sobbing sister at the scaffold, suited the narratives of the period after the United Irishmen Rebellion.
And also we have a letter between Henry Joy and Mary Anne where he's basically saying, you know, we should maybe think about setting up the United Irish Women, if you like to paraphrase it. And really she goes back to him and says, no, you know, we are one cause, we're one. It's one organisation. It's not, you know, potentially United Irish Women and United Irish Men. So yeah. Just go on.
You know, in previous generations, people like that there have been overshadowed in favour of men. There's no getting around that. But from what we've seen here, you know, she's what can be termed feminist, very radical, very concerned with children's rights and anti-slavery. So she's radical in every aspect of her life. And it's perhaps unfair that she was remembered in such a way for a long time. Is there anything else that you can tell us about her radical outlook?
I don't know about her radical outlook, but in terms of who she was as a person, that really gives us a sense of her identity and how she felt about life was the fact that she kept no savings herself and gave a lot of them to the poor. She only kept enough to keep her house and the family that was in it fed and clothed. But there was one instance on a house in Donegal Street, only a few hundred yards from where we're sitting now, where when her brother died, they could no longer afford the rent, but they had to buy themselves out of the lease. And the people of Belfast clubbed together and they put a subscription out, and the money comes in for the McCracken family to Mary Anne to buy them out of the lease. But it's stated that it is a loan and it is not an act of charity, because they knew that Mary Anne wouldn't have accepted it if it had been given to her free of charge as a charity case, because she never saw herself as that. But she did take the money and she did repay back some of the people who had been so generous to her in her time of need.
We see her, like, as you talk about the radical, the social reformer, educationist, but very much involved and interested in arts and culture too. And we know that the McCracken family more or less adopted in Edward Bunting. They looked after him and continued to do so throughout his life. That allowed him to literally go around Ireland and work with others and collect all of the old harp music. And he set up and established the Harp Festival then in Belfast too. So other links then into art and culture, like her interest in Irish language and all of the cultural traditions.
St Malachy's, just up behind the Poor House, have one of her original dictionaries of the Irish language, and with Mary Anne McCracken's signature in it. So we think that she was learning it both for cultural interest, but also to be able to go out and talk to the poor outside of Belfast, where there would have still been quite a large Irish-speaking communities in that area. And when it comes to the legacy of the United Irishmen, Mary Anne saw it as her almost right to look after those who were left, and also to protect the memory of her brother. So her brother was very close with Jimmy Hope. And when Jimmy Hope became destitute after the United Irishmen Rebellion, she ensured that the McCrackens took him in and gave him a job in their factory in the cotton spinning mill and made sure that he had some form of employment. And even in death, she marked the graves of Thomas Russell, who was a United Irishman who was executed for his role in the 1803 Rebellion, which was the remnants really of the United Irishmen under the leadership of Robert Emmet. when it came to Jimmy Hope, when he passed away, she put a headstone on his grave, and it cost quite a lot of money in those days. But unfortunately, nobody actually saw fit to mark her grave when she passed away. And it wasn't until 1909, until the supposed bones of Henry Joy McCracken were brought up from the parish graveyard up to Clifton Street Cemetery, that Frank Bigger decided to mark the grave. The stone just refers to Mary Ann McCracken as the lady who wept at her brother's scaffold. The final inscription on the headstone is what really strikes me, and it's the Irish for faithful or loyal until death. And this was put on referring to Henry Joy McCracken and the fact that she was at the scaffold. But when it actually comes to it, we like to think of it in the Poor House or the Belfast Charitable Society as faithful or loyal to the poor of Belfast until her death, because she didn't save a penny. She gave everything that she owned away.
Yeah. So just leading on from that, you know, in terms of what was her testimony, final inscription about loyalty, that has been interpreted by you, and it's been interpreted by people, other people, in different ways. What do you think now is her legacy, and what should it be? How should we remember her? If you want to call
Well, we're doing a few things in Belfast Charitable Society. We're actually in the process of setting up the Mary Ann McCracken Foundation, because when the board and staff started to talk about what that legacy should be, because she had done so much, you couldn't actually just pinpoint one individual thing. So we're currently in the process of republishing the Mary McNeill book, which went out of print in the 1960s. So we've updated it in terms of references, forewords and stuff like that, and that will go to print and be ready for the end of next summer. We have set up, as I say, the Mary Ann McCracken Foundation. We anticipate within that we will be giving out bursaries, awards for women who are doing work potentially internationally. We're looking at other activities in and around challenging discussion, challenging what is social reform today. So potentially facilitating discussions around modern day slavery, integrated education, those things that we see ran through, you know, Mary Ann's life. You know, we're looking potentially, we had a small play written about her life, and we may continue and do something like that again. There are another couple of sort of physical things. We're looking at a statue, and there's a bit of a discussion, a bit of a groundswell, if you like, around interest, around a statue to Mary Ann, but, you know, what it should be like, where it should be. So there are a few activities like that that we're looking at currently, and we really hope to drive a lot of this forward to be ready for her anniversary, the anniversary of her birth then in July 2020. So quite a few things on the back burner and working at the minute.
In terms of your own personal preference, if there was a statue to Mary Ann McCracken, where do you think that would be, and what era of her life do you think it should, you know, represent?
I personally, and again, you know, I would have to take a ring to my board, I personally think it really should be outside of the Poor House, in that area, and to me it should be probably when she was in maybe her 30s or 40s, that era, a bit like the bust that we have, that sort of age. But it should be linked to children. In my head, it's a statue of her, but almost with her hands out, because she was open, she was leading, she was bringing children to the Poor House and looking after them. Maybe even with children, you know, some statues of children around. There may be even a motto on the statue that says, what Mary Ann's motto was, which was, in life it's better to wear out than to rust out. There have been other discussions around having something down near the docks because of her work in terms of the anti-slavery movement and the fact that she did spend so much time going out and giving out leaflets there. So I think there are a lot of options, a lot of possibilities.
And what do you think, Aaron? Do you think how she should be represented?
I suppose I'm a wee bit biased in terms of working in the original Poor House, but I think with her involvement throughout the years, from making the clothes of the children age 5 or 6 herself, right up until her last days being walked up arm in arm up our driveway by Maria, the illegitimate daughter of Henry Joy McCracken that she took in, I think it would be quite fitting to be in that sort of area of Clifton Street and North Queen Street, because she was so involved with the Poor House. She lived in Donegal Street for the majority of her life. The house where the blue plaque is commemorating Mary Ann McCracken, she was only in it for a few months before her death. Mm-hmm. The McCracken family were in around High Street. Their factory was in Donegal Street and in Francis Street, so I think that's quite a nice area to tie it in and to draw people up from the Cathedral Quarter to show that there is history in North Belfast that is worth coming up to explore.
Yep. Thank you very much. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Paula. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of Clifton House coming up to the anniversary of Mary McCracken. Thank you very much.
Thank you.